and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Some big law firms are fighting back as President Trump is targeting offices whose advocacy clients or attorneys he dislikes.
Hold up our tax dollars? That is how terrorists behave.
And a war of words between Chicago's mayor and the White House is escalating. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and more. And now to some of today's top stories. Former President Joe Biden is making a return to the national stage tonight, right here in Chicago. At this hour, Biden is speaking at the National Conference of Advocates, Counselors, and Representatives for the Disabled in River North. He's focusing on the health of Social Security in his speech, as the Trump administration has planned to lay off 7,000 workers and impose tighter identity proofing measures for recipients. Typically, immediate past presidents keep a low profile, which Biden has largely done until now. Outgoing Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez is up for the top education job in Massachusetts. He's been named one of three finalists for the position of Commissioner of the Massachusetts Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. He and the others will interview for the job in a public board meeting on Thursday. Martinez has been the head of CPS since he was appointed by then-Mayor Lori Lightfoot in 2021, but he was terminated without cause by the then-appointed school board in December. The terms of his contract allow him to remain on the job until June. And if you haven't already filed your taxes, today is the deadline. The IRS says it's already received more than 100 million returns, but the agency is expecting tens of millions more today. So if you're hearing this and panicking, don't worry. You can still file until 11:59 tonight or submit an automatic six-month filing extension. You can check out our website for instructions on how to do that and other last-minute tips. If you don't file and haven't requested an extension, you may be subject to a penalty plus interest. Up next, the Trump administration goes after big legal firms. We explore the constitutional questions that raises.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Some of the nation's largest law firms have recently been faced with a stark choice: cooperate with the Trump administration or face punitive executive orders. As of Friday, five more big law firms gave in to President Trump's demands, committing to provide $600 million in pro bono legal work for the administration. That means President Trump has now secured commitments for almost $1 billion worth of free legal help from the country's most powerful law firms. Meanwhile, several firms, including Chicago-based Jenner & Block, are choosing to oppose the administration's demands. Joining us now to examine some of the constitutional issues this raises are Harold Krent, longtime former dean, constitutional law specialist, and now professor of law at Chicago-Kent College of Law. And joining us via Zoom is David Applegate, lawyer with Williams, Barber & Morrell, and member of the Libertarian and conservative-leaning Federalist Society. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Harold, I want to start with you first, please. Is this legal to use executive orders to target law firms that have displeased the president?
Several courts have already held that this is unconstitutional, and I think it's clearly unconstitutional. David probably agrees with me, at least on two grounds. You know, first, that it's a violation of the First Amendment because it impedes free speech. The message is, if you speak out against the administration, there's going to be retaliation, very serious retaliation. And second of all, it impedes people's abilities to get an attorney. You know, you're not going to be able to get people to represent you in immigration or other contexts against the administration for fear of reprisals. So on both grounds, I would predict that this would go down before the courts. And what really troubles me about this is how brazen it is. It's not that President Trump wasn't trying to hide anything. He said, because you were against me in some other context, I'm going to punish you. That's frightening.
And some of those contexts include, you know, hiring people who worked for his or represented some of his political opponents, among others. David Applegate, similar question to you. What kind of constitutional issues do you think this raises?
I think it raises exactly the ones that Harold has brought up and as Jenner has argued in its lawsuit. It also raises equal protection and due process arguments. Because the essential elements of due process are notice in a hearing. One might try to argue somewhat cleverly that, well, we issued one of these against a law firm before we issued the executive order against yours, so you were sort of on notice because you were doing the same things of which we disapproved, but I don't think any court is going to buy that. And as Jenner points out very starkly, there's been absolutely no kind of hearing on any of the factual issues that are being asserted, such as who is employed by whom, who took what positions, those sorts of things. And so I have to agree with Harold here that this raises serious First Amendment issues. It raises serious right to counsel issues. And it raises, dare I say it, both substantive and procedural due process issues, as well as some equal protection issues.
David, what might be the potential impact, you know, on a law firm's bottom line, really, on their business if they're shut out of government work and government contracts?
Well, the bottom line could be quite severe. As Jenner points out, there are at least two aspects to this. One is the ability to represent clients in of their choice, with the clients having the legal counsel of their choice, which can deprive firms of revenue source. And the second is rather clever but somewhat disingenuous argument that the time spent responding to these executive orders is time that cannot be spent on paying clients. It's interesting to note that according to Bloomberg Law, at least, the firms that have reached agreements with the administration have roughly twice the profits per partner of the firms that have not. Now, that's historical, not forward-looking necessarily, but big law firms are big business with revenues in the billions of dollars and expenses to match. And the inability to represent clients either before the government or suing the government because you can't have access to government buildings and or security clearances, it can make a dramatic difference on any firm's bottom line.
The president's attack on law firms, it's also caused some divisions within the legal profession, within the law firms themselves. Some of those firms, as we've discussed, they've acquiesced to the administration's demands. Others are fighting back. As David mentioned, the Jenner and Block argument. Harold, what conversations are these firms having when they're weighing the factors and figuring out how to respond?
I mean, it's nobody envies the situation of these law firms, right? They have the potential to be shut out of the government market. Also, I want to add that the president's executive orders also threatens vengeance against anybody who does business with those law firms. And so it's hard to get clients if you're being threatened by the federal government. So on the one hand, and in addition, the executive order says that the members of the law firm, the lawyers, should they leave the law firm, can't even get federal governmental work afterwards. So for all these pressures on the law firm on the one hand, on the other hand, it's what dare one say it, integrity, doing what you believe, and there's a price to pay for that, as we've been talking about. So it's not an easy decision, and obviously law firms are divided and going both ways. Twice as many law firms now have these settlement agreements than have decided to sue. Four have sued. I think this will come to an end relatively quickly because I think that the courts will be unanimous in saying this goes way beyond the pale and this activity by the president is clearly unconstitutional.
Now, as of Friday, Trump has secured almost $1 billion worth of free legal services, as we mentioned, from some of, you know, what are the most powerful law firms in the country. Does that raise legal concerns, the agreements themselves, Harold?
Well, in one way, yes, one way, no. I mean, most of the agreements for pro bono, I think, are causes that everybody could agree with, helping veterans, first responders, and I think that'll be efforts by the law firms to put to good use. But on the other hand, these agreements themselves are the process of coercion. And there's an imbalance of power of the federal government as opposed to these law firms, even though law firms are sophisticated. And it's possible that even these agreements may be subject to being overturned in the courts as sort of contracts of adhesion because it's simply unfair.
Similar question to you, David, because some of the firms, as Harold mentioned, they have said that, yes, we'll agree to doing this pro bono work because there are issues, you know, that we share the same interest as the administration. Is that reason enough to make a deal? If you're already doing that work, then just do that work rather than make a deal. How do you read that?
Well, your position, Brandis, is obviously a fairly straightforward argument. If you're going to do it, you're going to do it. But at least one of these settling law firms, Paul Weiss, issued a statement, again, according to Bloomberg Law, saying that what we're doing is entirely consistent with our statement of principles set down over 60 years ago, because we are now maintaining, by affirmative efforts, a membership of partners reflecting a wide variety of clients with a wide variety of interests. We don't just take popular causes on one side or the other, but we're doing work now against illegal immigration, upholding veterans' rights, as Harold has mentioned, and even supporting the administration's position that there are only two genders. But there's one little interesting aspect here that I've not heard discussed, and that is slightly clever, but I don't think it's going to make this pass muster, is that if you read the executive orders carefully, they all say that consistent with existing law, to the extent consistent with the law, this executive order applies. And as Harold has said, and I agree, I think the courts are going to find fairly quickly that these are not consistent with the law and the Constitution.
And to that point, you know, are these agreements even legally binding? We've got Crane Chicago Business reporting just this afternoon that Chicago-based Kirkland and Ellis, which did make a deal with the administration, that they don't have anything in writing, that this agreement was pretty much announced on Truth Social, the president's social media. If there's nothing in writing?
Well, contracts can be oral, subject to the statute of frauds, which has a variety of exceptions to it. I think the stronger argument here would be Harold's argument of contracts of adhesion done under coercion. But if the law firm, you know, genuinely wants to say, we value the ability to represent the clients we represent and obtain the fees that we obtain, and the positions that the administration is asking us to support are not contrary to our values, that's not necessarily coercion in a legal sense, although certainly it looks like it on the face of it.
What if the courts, Harold, should say these deals aren't binding, they're not enforceable, and they're wrong for various and sundry reasons? Should we be concerned about the administration actually doing what the court says, as he seems to not be doing with regards to some deportations?
Well, that's the inflection point. You know, what's going to happen with the series of questions like this? El Salvador, with Garcia, who's being taken there against his will, and the administration not wanting to return him, even though he's been ordered to. What if the administration doesn't follow a court order? That's when you get the constitutional crisis. It's simmering now. I hope it doesn't flare up, but it certainly could, because in this case, and the cases of immigration and in other contexts, when the administration doesn't like what the courts say, what are they going to do?
Okay, and that was my next question. Are we on course for a full-blown constitutional crisis? We're going to talk about that next time you all are both here, because I'm sure there will be more to discuss. Harold Krent, David Applegate, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Too much, Brandis.
Up next, Mayor Johnson's choice words for the president. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and much more right after this. We'll be right back. Tensions between President Donald Trump and Mayor Brandon Johnson are escalating. Meanwhile, Chicago police progress meeting towards meeting consent decree goals, and prosecutors rest their case in Senator Emile Jones III's federal corruption trial. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Heather Sharone and Nick Blumberg. Welcome back, team. So let's start with this. Some tough talk from Mayor Johnson for the president today.
Trying to force your will to break the spirit of working people in order to have a conversation, that's terrorism. We're not going to negotiate with terrorists.
And of course, that was at a City Hall news conference today. The mayor talking about the president's efforts to strip federal funding from cities like Chicago with laws on the books to protect undocumented immigrants, saying that it amounts to terrorism. Heather, did the mayor call the president a terrorist?
He did not, but he made it clear that that he finds it inappropriate that the president has linked almost $4 billion in federal aid to the city with the city's protections to undocumented immigrants. And essentially, what Trump has been saying since he took office in his second term is that if the city continues to protect undocumented immigrants by forbidding Chicago police officers from helping federal immigration agents, that we will lose that money. He says it's a clear sense of extortion.
Okay, so let's keep it going, because it's taken since 2022, Nick, to get to this point. But the corruption trial of State Senator Emile Jones III, it's moved quickly since it started a week ago. What is the latest?
It has. This was not the epic length Madigan trial that I think, certainly journalists and jurors might have been worried that it would be. Prosecutors rested their case today, and the defense has started to take up their arguments in court. We found out today that Senator Jones will be testifying in his own defense. In fact, he began that testimony for an hour or two this afternoon before the judge broke for the day. Defense attorneys, doing some table setting, trying to go through his life story a little bit, help, folks on the jury know a little bit more about him, how he got to be where he is today. Obviously, he comes from a political family with his father, the former Senate president. But prosecutors were really trying to hammer home their points in their final moments, saying that the way that Jones represented himself in an interview with FBI agents did not comport to the information that was recorded on a wire by the former executive of a red light speed camera company, who, Jones is accused of asking for a bribe, asking for a job for an intern. When he spoke with the FBI, initially the same day as a raid on offices of the, at the state capitol of Senator Martin Sandoval.
Yep.
Yeah. He kind of walked it back. He sort of slow walked to learn, kind of tried to soft pedal, I should say, what the actual conversations that he was recorded, being involved in were. So anyhow, this is his chance to present a defense. Obviously, always a huge risk to take the stand in your own defense.
And he's taking that chance, yeah.
Well, and it's the kind of thing that you think one of the big issues in many of these corruption cases is A, the allegations themselves, but B, lying to the feds, which he is accused of doing. So I think this, could be a key opportunity from his defense attorney's, standpoint here to try and explain some of that.
Heather, City Council expected to approve a $32 million settlement tomorrow that will exhaust the city's entire police misconduct budget for the year. You asked the mayor for his thoughts on that today.
We have inherited quite the mess, right? Many of these cases that we're referring to happened, decades ago.
So, Heather, any sign that the city is going to take a new approach in resolving these lawsuits?
Well, I asked the mayor that, and he deferred to Corporation Counsel Mary Richardson Lowry, who said, look, when we look at all of these cases and that we've created a new division to look specifically at the cases that involve three Chicago police officers, former Chicago police officers, who have uncontested records of misconduct, and that's former Commander John Burge, former Detective Ronaldo Gravera, and former Sergeant Ronald Watts. And she said, it's really not possible to do a settlement of all of those lawsuits, which total more than 200, because all of those plaintiffs are represented by different defense attorneys. Now, I've spoken with some of those defense attorneys who say, well, we can play well together. Our goal is to sort of resolve this for our clients. It's clear that the city doesn't see that an option, which means that the city is going to actually have to sort of deal with these cases case by case by case. And the ultimate toll to taxpayers is really sort of, you know, astronomical. Now, tomorrow at the city council meeting, Albert Gilbert Villegas is going to sort of try to use a parliamentary maneuver to put the Johnson administration on the spot and force them to come back before the city council and sort of answer questions about if this is really the best strategy, which often involves paying millions of dollars to private lawyers to defend these officers, despite those records of misconduct. Whether he gets anywhere, that's going to be an open question.
Well, and you have to imagine from the perspective of the attorneys representing all those, you know, alleged torture victims, you know, they have to look at this and say, if the city's going case by case by case, is that going to delay any resolution, any sort of restitution made to my clients? So, you know, the idea that this needs to be handled one by one, certainly, you know, those folks, it's in their interest to play well together. It's in their clients' interest, one has to imagine, in terms of trying to get a speedier resolution to these cases that have already dragged on for decades.
For so many of them. So, Nick, also, public transit facing a bit of a fiscal crisis itself. Would you, though? The end of the legislative session in Springfield fast approaching. Today, the Regional Transportation Authority held a solutions summit downtown. Did anything? What came of that?
Well, we don't necessarily have a final solutions from that summit.
No, you know,
we don't,
finale,
not final resolution, yes. But no, there was obviously a lot of conversation about this looming $771 million fiscal cliff for the region's three transit systems that's set to hit next year when COVID relief money runs out. It was interesting. They actually had a couple of leaders from some of their peer agencies, one of the agencies that oversees Bay Area Transit, and the head of WMATA in Washington, D.C., who have faced a lot of the similar sort of structural problems that CTA, Metra, PACE, RTA are dealing with. And there was a lot of conversation about the fact that, you know, the end of the legislative session is very fast approaching. And if they don't have a resolution for that fiscal crisis, they're going to have to start some legally mandated procedures to kind of game play out what these cuts, what these fare hikes, all these different things, what they might be like, what the effect on passengers would be. So there really does seem to be a growing sense of urgency, both with, you know, folks in the room, folks in Springfield. Now, there was, you know, we did hear some confidence from transit leaders that their message is getting through. And it was interesting, too. You know, a lot of this they've talked about the impact of all these different cuts, the things they could do with extra funding. Acting CTA President Nora Learson went out of her way to say today, look, one of the things we need to talk about is equity. You know, Chicago is a, you know, de facto very segregated city because of redlining and racial covenants. Better transit access is a way to address those sorts of inequities. So she was it was very interesting to hear her make a pitch, not just on the service side, not just on, you know, the economic impact of transit on the region, but saying, you know, to political leaders and transit advocates in the room, this is a way to address some wrongs of the past.
All right. Heather, update on the police consent decree. Friday, an independent monitor filing its latest report, I think the 11th. CPD's made some progress.
That's right. So the last report showed that the CPD was just in 9% compliance, full compliance with the report. They are now at 16% compliance. And that is the largest jump between six-month periods since the consent decree went into effect 6 years ago. Now, what changed really was concentrated in the area of the consent decree that governs use of force. A lot of the sort of requirements mean that the police department has to have a way to sort of track every time that officers use force, and they are now doing a full job of doing that according to the monitors. Now, Larry Snelling says, the superintendent, that this is a reflection of how hard he has worked since taking office nearly a year and a half ago to really prioritize doing the consent decree right, not rushing through it. However, it's been 6 years, and there are a lot of questions about whether the police department will sort of get this to sort of closer to full compliance, because as I've reported before, this agreement really requires the police department to be restructured, and that is a huge lift, and it will require the completion of an ongoing study about where and why officers are deployed, there has to be a system that will flag officers who are the subject of multiple complaints, oh, and lawsuits, not to mention that. And they have to sort of do a better job of making sure that officers who engage in misconduct or even make mistakes are either retrained or disciplined.
Okay. And hopefully it won't take another 6 years to make 16% more.
I will be here, though, to keep track on it.
Yes, you will. All right, Heather Giroux, Nick Blumberg. Thanks, gang.
Thank you.
And we're back to wrap things up right after this. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Stay connected with our reporters, these folks, what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. We're one-on-one with Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates about the now ratified contract and the historic road it took to get there. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm serving Chicago for 37 years.